tied up with a scarf of the same color. On the other side of the street is a black jeep. Nelly shades her face with one hand as she looks down towards the water. Eric walks across the grass and steps across some low bushes and is just emerging onto the pavement when Nelly catches sight of him. Her lips part as though she were suddenly frightened. Eric looks round for traffic, then walks straight across the road in his wet underpants. Nelly looks him quickly up and down, then lifts her chin as if they were about to have a perfectly ordinary discussion about patience. "Original, but quite sexy," she smiles, quickly opening the back door. "Get under the blanket." He huddles down on the floor behind the seat and pulls the red rug over himself. The sun-heated car smells of plastic and leather. Eric hears Nelly get in the driver's seat and close the door. She starts the engine and pulls away to the left, bumping off the curb and then speeding up, and he slides back towards the seat. "We know Rocky was wrongly convicted of the murder of Rebecca Hanson, but not now, Nelly," he interrupts. "But do we know he's innocent of these new murders? I mean, what if he started copying the murder he was convicted of, just to put the blame on you?" "It's not him. I hypnotized him. He saw the preacher and..." "But couldn't he just have divided himself into different characters, so that he's the unclean preacher when he commits the murders?" Nelly falls silent and inserts a disc into the CD player. The car fills with Johnny Cash's heavy voice.
"Wanted man in California, wanted man in Buffalo, wanted man in Kansas City, wanted man in Ohio, wanted man in Mississippi, wanted man in Old Cheyenne. Wherever you might look tonight, you might see this wanted man."
Eric lies there with the blanket on top of him, smelling the sand on the mats on the floor, and can't help smiling at the fact that Nelly is trying to be funny at a time like this. Chapter 116. Rocky is asleep on the passenger seat next to Yuna. His big head lolls to the side when the road bends. The landscape is sparsely populated and desolate, almost abandoned. Yuna is driving fast, thinking about the text message Lumi sent him earlier today. She wrote that she loves Paris, but misses their conversations up in Natavara. Just beyond Flien, the road and railway come together on two narrow strips of land. A long goods train thunders past next to the car, closer and closer. The brown trucks reflect off the water. The road and rails converge at an arrowhead. The train passes beneath them and then appears alongside again before dark pine forest comes between them. The forest gradually grows thinner, and the landscape flattens into huge fields. Combine harvesters roll across the fields in clouds of dust, cutting off the stalks and separating wheat from chaff. Schöldinger is on Route 55, not far from Katrineholm. Yuna turns off to the right and sees a few red houses through the trees. Then the sandy-colored church with its pointed spire rising from the plain. Schöldinger Church. An ordinary Swedish church out in the countryside, dating back to the 12th century, surrounded by rune stones. The gravel crunches beneath the tires as he pulls over and stops in front of the parish house. Maybe they have found the serial killer now. The preacher from Rocky's nightmarish memories. The old priest with rouged cheeks and arms full of needle tracks. The church door is closed and the windows dark. Yuna pulls his Colt Combat from its holster and notices that the tape is dirty and has started to peel off. He usually wraps sports tape round the lower part of the butt so that his hand doesn't slip if he finds himself in a drawn-out firefight. He pulls out the magazine and checks that it's full, presses it back in, and feeds a bullet into the chamber, even though he can't really believe that the unclean preacher is just waiting for them inside the church. Nothing is that simple. The path has been raked, and the churchyard is well tended. The sun is filtering through the leaves of a huge oak. The preacher is an extremely dangerous man, a serial killer who never rushes, who takes his time, who watches and plans down to the last detail until something else takes over and he turns into a wild animal. His weakness is his arrogance, his narcissistic hunger. Yuna glances towards the church, then across the fields. He has two extra magazines of ordinary parabellum bullets in one pocket and one magazine of fully jacketed ammunition in the other. Even if the preacher isn't here, he thinks, even if he's never been here, this is the end of the road. If he can't find something here that can convince Margot, then it's over. Eric will be found guilty, even though he's innocent, just like Rocky was found guilty years ago of murdering Rebecca Hanson. And the serial killer will go free. Today is the day everything gets decided. Eric can't keep on running. He's got nowhere left to go. The hunters will drive him out of the forest. And he himself has broken an inmate out of jail, used violence against a prison officer, threatened his life. Disa would have said he was just understimulated, that he needs to get back to work. It's too late for that now. But he had no choice, in which case the consequences are irrelevant. When Yuna opens the door, Rocky wakes up and looks at him with narrow, sleepy eyes. "Wait here," Yuna says, and leaves the car. Rocky gets out and spits on the ground, leans against the roof of the car, and draws a line in the dirt with his hand. "Do you recognize where we are?" Yuna asks. "No," Rocky says, looking up at the church. "But that doesn't mean anything." "I want you to wait in the car," Yuna repeats. "I don't think the serial killer's here, but it could still be a dangerous situation." "I don't give a shit," Rocky says bluntly. He follows Yuna between the graves. The air is fresh, as if it had just been raining. They pass a man in jeans and a t-shirt, standing outside the porch, smoking and talking on his mobile. The transition from bright sunlight leaves them almost completely blind when they walk into the darkness of the porch. Yuna moves quickly to one side, ready to draw his pistol. He blinks and waits for his eyes to adapt before going in amongst the pews beneath the organ loft. Huge pillars hold up the roof and ornate frescoes. There's a knocking sound and a shadow flits across the walls. There's someone sitting in one of the front pews. Yuna stops Rocky, draws his gun and holds it hidden beside his hip. A bird hits the window. It looks like a jackdaw that's got caught in a piece of twine and keeps hitting the window when it tries to fly off. The door to the sacristy is ajar. On the wall is a hazy cross in a circle. Yuna slowly approaches the huddled figure from behind and sees a wrinkled hand holding onto the back of the pew in front. The bird hits the window again. The shrunken figure slowly turns its head towards the sound. It's an elderly Chinese woman. Yuna carries on past her, still concealing his gun, and looks at her from the side. Her face is downcast, impassive. Beside the medieval font, Mary sits like a child. Her wide wooden dress falls in heavy folds around her feet. At the center of the altarpiece, Christ hangs on the cross against a sky of gold, just as Rocky described it under hypnosis. This was where he first met the unclean preacher, when the entire church was full of priests. Now he's back. Rocky has stopped in the darkened doorway beneath the organ loft. The instrument's pipes stick up above him like a row of quill pens. He's standing still, irresolute. Like an apostate, he doesn't look up at the altar and just stares down at his big, empty hands. The Chinese woman stands up and walks out. Yuna knocks on the door of the sacristy, nudges the door open slightly, and peers into the gloom. A set of vestments is hanging ready, but the room looks empty. Yuna steps aside and looks into the gap between the hinges, sees the uneven stone wall like billowing fabric. He opens the door further and walks in, his pistol at his chest. He quickly looks round at the liturgical textiles. High above, pale daylight filters in through a deep alcove. Yuna crosses the floor to the toilet and opens the door, but there's no one there. There's a wristwatch on the shelf above the hand basin. He raises his pistol and opens the door to the wardrobe. Chasubles, cassocks, and stoles hang side by side, different colors for different seasons of the religious calendar. Yuna quickly pushes the clothes aside and looks towards the back of the wardrobe. There's something on the floor in one corner, a pile of magazines about sports cars. Yuna returns to the nave and walks past Rocky, who has sat down in one of the pews, and goes outside where he asks the man by the door where the priest is. "That's me," the man smiles, dropping his cigarette in the empty coffee mug by his feet. "I mean the other priest," Yuna explains. "There's only me here," he says. Yuna has already looked at his arms. They're free of injection scars. "When were you ordained?"
"I was ordained as a curate in Katrineholm, and 4 years ago I was appointed as the priest here," the man replies amiably.
"Who was here before you?"
"That was Richard Magnusson, and before him Erland Ludin, and Peter Lear Jakobsson, Mikael Fries, and I can't remember."
The man has cut his hand. There's a grubby plaster across his palm. "This probably sounds like a strange question," Yuna says, "but when would a church be full of priests, in the pews, like the congregation?"
"When a priest is ordained, but that would be in a cathedral," the priest replies helpfully, picking his mug up off the ground.
"But here," Yuna persists, "has this church ever been full of priests?"
"That would be for a priest's funeral, but that's up to the family to decide. It depends who gets invited. There are no special rules for priests."
"Have you buried priests here?"
The man looks out across the headstones, the narrow paths, and neatly trimmed bushes. "I know that Peter Lear Jakobsson is buried here in the churchyard," he says quietly.
They go inside the porch, and the young priest's arms get goosebumps from the coolness of the stone. "When did he die?" Yuna asks.
"Long before I got here. 15 years ago, maybe. I don't know."
"Is there a record of who was here when he was buried?"
The man shakes his head and thinks for a moment. "No record, but his sister would know. She still lives in the widow's home owned by the parish. He was a widower and looked after her."
Yuna goes back inside the dimly lit church. Rocky is standing smoking beneath the medieval triumphal cross above the rood screen. Jesus and his entire emaciated body is dotted with red wounds like an old heroin addict.
"What does ossa ipsius in pace mean?" Yuna asks.
"Why do you want to know?"
"You said it under hypnosis."
"It means his bones are at peace,"
Rocky says in a rough voice. "You were describing a dead priest,"
That's why he was wearing makeup. They walk quickly under the arch towards the door as Yuna thinks about Rocky's description of a funeral service with an open coffin. The deceased priest was made up and dressed in a white cassock, but he wasn't the unclean preacher. The funeral was simply the first time Rocky met him. Chapter 117. Beneath an ornate wrought iron arch bearing the name Friedhelm, a flight of stone steps leads up to the parish home for clergymen's widows, where Pieter Leo Jakobson's older sister, Eleanor, was given permission to stay on after his death. Together with a younger woman from the Schöldinger village, she runs a cafe with a small exhibition about the village and what life was like in bygone times for priests and their families. Friedhelm consists of three red cottages with white window frames and gables, open shutters, and old-fashioned tiles on the roofs. The houses sit on three sides of a neat patch of lawn, with cafe tables beneath the weeping birch trees. The two men enter the cafe and pass through a cramped room lined with framed black-and-white photographs. Yuna glances along the pictures of buildings, teams of workers, priests' families. Three glass cabinets contain mourning jewelry made of jet, letters, inventories, and hymn books. Inside the pleasant cafe, Yuna buys two cups of coffee and a plate of biscuits from an elderly woman in a flowery apron. She looks nervously at Rocky, who doesn't smile back when she tells them that the price includes a refill. "Excuse me," Yuna says, "but you must be Eleanor, Pieter Leo Jakobson's sister." The woman gives him a quizzical nod. When Yuna explains that they've just spoken to the new priest, who said so many nice things about her brother, her clear blue eyes fill with tears.
"Pieter was very, very popular," she says in a tremulous voice, then tries to catch her breath.
"You must have been very proud of him," Yuna smiles.
"Yes, I was."
In a rather touching gesture, she pulls her hands together over her stomach in an effort to calm down.
"There's something I was wondering," Yuna goes on. "Did your brother have a particular colleague, someone he worked closely with?"
"Yes, that would have been the rural dean in Katrineholm and the vicars of Fluda and Stora Malm. And I know he spent a lot of time in Lerbu Church towards the end."
"Did they see each other privately as well?"
"My brother was a fine man," she says, "an honorable man, very well liked."
Eleanor looks around the empty room, then walks round the counter and shows Yuna a framed newspaper cutting from the King and Queen's visit to Strängnäs.
"Pieter was chaplain at the Jubilee service in the cathedral," she says in a proud voice. "The bishop thanked him afterwards and..."
"Show her your arms," Yuna tells Rocky.
Without changing his expression at all, Rocky rolls up the sleeves of his top.
"My brother was the orator at the diocesan meeting in Hernesand, and he..."
The old woman trails off when she sees Rocky's ravaged arms, uneven and stained from hundreds of injection scars, dark with veins that have disintegrated from the ascorbic acid he's used to dissolve the heroin.
"He's a priest too,"
Yuna says, without taking his eyes off her.
"Anyone can get trapped."
Eleanor's wrinkled face turns pale and motionless. She sits down on the wooden bench with her hand over her mouth.
"My brother changed after the accident, when his wife passed away," she says in a quiet voice. "Grief destroyed him. He withdrew from everyone. Thought someone was following him, that everyone was spying on him."
"When was this?"
16 years ago.
What did your brother use to inject himself with?
She looks at him with exhausted eyes.
On the boxes it said, morphine epidural.
The woman shakes her head and her old hands flutter restlessly over her apron.
I didn't know anything. He was all alone in the end. Not even his daughter could stand it. She looked after him for as long as she could, but now I understand why she couldn't go on.
But he was still able to conduct services, do his job?
She raises her bloodshot eyes towards Yuna.
Oh, yes, he conducted his services. No one noticed anything, not even me, because we no longer spent any time together. But I used to go to the morning service, and everyone said his sermons were stronger than ever, even though he himself was growing weaker.
Rocky mutters something and walks away from them. They watch him through the window as he emerges onto the lawn and goes and sits down at a table under the weeping birch.
How did you find out? Yuna asks.
I was the one who found him, the old woman replies. I was the one who took care of the body.
Was it an overdose?
I don't know. He'd missed the morning service, so I went into the rectory. There was a terrible stench in there. I found him in the cellar. He had been dead for 3 days, naked and filthy, covered in scabs. He was lying in the cage like an animal.
He was lying in a cage?
She nods and wipes her nose.
All he had was a mattress and a can of water,
she whispers.
Didn't you think it was odd that he was in a cage?
The old woman shakes her head.
It had been locked from the inside. I've always thought that he tried to lock himself in to escape the drugs.
A younger woman in a similar apron comes out and stands behind the counter when some more customers arrive.
Could one of your brother's colleagues have helped him write his sermons? Yuna asks.
I don't know.
He probably had a computer. Could I take a look at it?
He had one in the office, but he wrote his sermons by hand.
Have you kept them?
Eleanor slowly stands up from the bench.
I took care of his estate, she says. I cleaned out the rectory so that there wouldn't be any gossip. But he'd got rid of everything. There were no photographs, no letters or sermons. I couldn't even find his diaries. He'd always kept a diary. He used to keep them locked up in his bureau, but it was empty.
Could they be anywhere else?
She stands still and her mouth moves silently until the words come.
I've only got one diary left. It was hidden in the drinks cabinet. They usually have a secret compartment at the back where gentlemen could keep their saucy French postcards.
What did it say in the diary? Yuna says.
She smiles and shakes her head.
I would never read it. You don't do that sort of thing.
Of course not, he replies.
But many years ago, Pieter used to get his diaries out at Christmas and read about mother and father and about ideas for sermons. He wrote very well.
The door to the cafe opens once more, and a draught sweeps through the cozy room, spreading the smell of fresh coffee.
Do you have the diary here? Yuna asks.
It's in the exhibition,
she says.
We call it a museum, but it's really just a few things we found here.
He goes with her to the exhibition. An enlarged photograph from 1850 shows three thin women in black dresses in front of the home for widows. The buildings look almost black. The picture was taken early one spring. The trees are bare, and there's still snow in the furrows of the field. Beneath the picture is a short caption about the priest who had Friedhelm built so that his wife wouldn't have to marry the next priest if he died before her. Next to the earrings and necklace of polished jade lies a rusty key and a small color photograph showing the funeral of Pieter Leah Jakobson. A man dressed in black is acting as marshal of ceremonies, holding the black veil. The bishop and the priest's daughter and sister are standing by the coffin, with their faces lowered. They walk past pictures of the mine at Kantorp, women and children sorting the ore in bright sunshine, Schildinger workhouse, and the opening of the railway station. One black-and-white photograph of the church has been hand-tinted, so that the sky is pastel blue, the vegetation looks tropical, and the wooden construction of the new steeple shines like polished bronze.
"Here's the diary,"
Eleanor says, stopping in front of a glass cabinet containing an array of objects. Chapter 118. On top of a linen cloth lies a rusty hair grip, a pocket watch, a white hymn book bearing the name Anna in gold writing, a page of old church accounts, Luther's small catechism, and the priest's diary, with a lilac strap round its stained leather binding. The old woman looks at Una with frightened eyes as she opens the case and removes the diary. On the front page, in ornate handwriting, are the words Pieter Leah Jakobson, Priest, Volume 24.
"I don't think it's right to read other people's diaries," she says with a hint of anxiety in her voice.
"No," Una says, and opens the book. He sees at once that it's old. The first entry is dated almost 20 years ago.
"We don't have the right to..."
"I have to," Una interrupts. He leafs through, staring at the handwriting in the hope of finding something about the person who wrote Pieter's sermons.
"The administration of the parish has become more onerous, the guidelines stricter. I fear that finances will come to govern my church more and more. Why not start selling indulgences again?"
Crossed out.
"Today is the fifth Sunday after Epiphany, and the liturgical colors are getting darker again. The theme is sowing and reaping. I don't like the warning in Paul's letter to the Galatians about not mocking God. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. But sometimes you haven't sown, yet must still reap. I can't say that to my congregation. They want to hear about the riches of heaven."
Una looks up and sees the old woman leave the room with her hands hanging by her sides.
"I met the pasty-faced contract priest in Lerbo for a private conversation. He was probably expecting me to talk about my drinking. He's young, but his faith is so strong that it makes me feel bad. I decided not to visit him again. My daughter is growing up now. The other day I watched her without her knowing. She was sitting in front of the mirror. She had her hair just like Anna's and was smiling to herself. Today is the fifth Sunday after Easter. The theme for the sermon is growing in faith. I think about grandmother and grandfather who went to Guinea before they moved to the farm in Ruslagen. In my congregation, there is no place for missionary work, and that makes me wonder."
Una sits down on one of the old chairs beneath the photographs. He leafs through the book, reading about the duties of the liturgical year, Christmas carols, summer services at some mill or other. He goes back through it again, looking for any further mention of the priest in Lerbo, and finds himself in the middle of Easter.
"The Gospels turn their attention to the empty grave, but around the dinner table we talked about the Old Testament text describing the last plague to strike Egypt. My daughter said that God loves blood, and referred to one of Easter's biblical texts.
and the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. My wife and I haven't shared a bedroom for a year now. I usually stay up late, and I snore like a mechanical digger, according to her. But we often sneak into each other at night. Sometimes I go with Anna to her bedroom in the evening just to watch her get ready. I've always liked watching her take off her jewelry at night, pressing the little studs back onto her earrings and putting them in the case next to each other. Anna is quietly attentive to detail. She doesn't reach behind her back when she takes her bra off, but slips the straps over her shoulders, slides the bra down to her waist, and turns it round before unfastening it. When I sat on her bed last night, watching her plait her hair ready for bed, I thought I could see a face at the dark window. I got up and went over, but I couldn't see anything. So I went out onto the veranda, then into the garden, but everything was quiet, and I looked up at the starry sky instead. Yuna looks out of the window and sees that Rocky is still sitting under the tree with his eyes closed and legs outstretched. He carries on reading. I saw the pasty-faced priest from Lerbo in the supermarket yesterday, but didn't have to say hello. Crossed out. Fourth Sunday in Lent. So we have reached the midpoint of Lent. Headache. Sat up late, drinking wine, reading and writing. Today we think about the bread of life. The holy days of Easter are almost upon us, and the heavy fist of existence presses us to the ground. Yuna leafs forward, glancing at the pages about Trinity Sunday and the transition to the gentler half of the church calendar, before stopping abruptly and reading. It has happened. Terrible, impossible. I shall write about it here and beg God for forgiveness. Then I shall never mention it again. My hand is shaking as I write this, 2 days later. Like old Lot, I was tricked into breaking the Lord's commandment. But I am writing to understand my role in this, my share of the guilt. Got rather late, and I drank more wine than I could handle, more than I usually do, and I was drunk when I went to bed and fell asleep. In hindsight, I think I was aware on some level that it wasn't Anna who crept into my bed in the darkness. She smelled like Anna. She was wearing my wife's jewelry and nightshirt, but she was scared. Her body was trembling as I lay on top of her. She didn't whisper at all. She didn't sigh like Anna. She was breathing as if to resist giving in to pain. I tried to turn on the lamp. I was still so drunk that it fell to the floor. I stood up, staggered, followed the wall with my hand, and turned on the main light. In my bed sat my daughter. She was wearing makeup and smiling, even though she was scared. I roared, I shouted, and rushed over and tore Anna's earrings from her ears. I rubbed her face on the blood-stained sheet. I dragged her down the stairs and out into the snow. I slipped and fell, got up again, and shoved her away. She was freezing, and her ears were bleeding, but she was still smiling. I shall be punished. I must be punished. I should have seen this coming. Isolation and blossoming, her creeping, spying, always fiddling with Anna's jewelry and makeup. Yuna stops reading. Looks at the rusty key and the black earrings in the case, and at the text about having to take on the last priest's wife. He leaves the exhibition with the diary in his hand,
passing the picture of the skinny widows. Out in the cafe, Eleanor is putting small coffee cups on saucers on the shelf behind the counter. The porcelain tinkles gently as she stacks it. A lethargic fly has flown in through the open doors and is now bouncing against the window as it tries to get out. Eleanor turns round when she hears Una come in. It's clear from her face that she regrets mentioning her brother's diary. "Can I ask how Pieter's wife died?"
"I don't know," she says curtly, and carries on stacking cups and saucers.
"You said you were friends, you and Anna."
The old woman's chin trembles.
"I think you should leave now," she says.
"I can't," Una replies.
"I thought you were interested in Pieter's sermons. That's why I..."
She shakes her head, picks up a tray containing coffee and two pastries, and starts to walk towards the door. Una follows her, holding the door for her and waiting as she takes the tray over to the customers in the garden.
"I don't want to talk about it," she says weakly.
"It wasn't an accident," he asks sharply.
Her face becomes completely helpless, and she looks like she's about to cry.
"I don't want to," she pleads. "Don't you understand? It's too late."
She lowers her face and sobs quietly to herself. The other woman comes in and puts her hands on Eleanor's shaking shoulders. The other customers get up and change tables.
"I'm a police officer," Una says. "I can find this out, but please leave now," the other woman says, hugging Eleanor.
"It was just an accident,"
the old priest's sister says.
"I don't want to upset you," Una goes on, "but I need to know what happened, and I need to know now."
"It was a car accident," Eleanor whimpers. "It was pouring with rain. They drove straight into the church wall. The car buckled and crushed Anna. She hit her face so badly that..."
She sits down unsteadily at one of the tables and stares ahead of her.
"Go on," Una says gently.
The woman looks up at him, wipes the tears from her eyes, and nods.
"We saw it from the rectory. My brother ran out down the road, and I followed him through the rain and saw their daughter fighting to get her out. She was using the car jack, kept hitting it against the car, and I just screamed and ran off through the thicket of willow."
The woman's voice cracks, and she opens and closes her mouth a couple of times before she goes on.
"There was broken glass and wreckage from the car everywhere, and there was a smell of petrol and hot metal. Their daughter had given up. She was just standing there, waiting for her father to get there. I can still remember the look of shock in her eyes, and her peculiar smile."
Eleanor raises her hands and looks down at her palms.
"Dear God," she whispers. "The girl had just got home from Klukhammer school, and there she was, standing there in her yellow raincoat, looking at her mother. Anna's face was crushed beyond recognition. There was blood everywhere, all over."
Her voice fails her again, and she swallows, then continues slowly.
"Memory is a strange thing," she says. "I know I heard a very high voice as I got closer through the rain. It was like a child talking. And then it started to burn. I saw a blue bubble enclose Anna. And the next moment I was lying in the wet grass in the ditch. And the flames were spiraling around the whole car. The birch tree alongside caught fire, and I..."
"Who was driving?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"The daughter," Una says. What's her name?
Nelly,
the old woman replies, looking up at him with exhaustion etched on her face. Chapter 119.
Yuna tries to call Eric as he walks between the cafe tables towards Rocky. His phone is switched off. He dials Margot Silverman's private number, but there's no answer. So he calls his former boss at the National Criminal Investigation Department, Carlos Eliasson, instead, and leaves a short voicemail. Rocky is still sitting in the shade under the weeping birch, picking biscuit crumbs from his stomach. He's taken his shoes and socks off and is wriggling his toes on the grass. We have to go, Yuna says when he reaches him.
Did you find the answers to your questions?
Yuna carries on past Rocky and hurries down the steps towards the car park. He's thinking that Pieter didn't keep volume 24 of his diary in the bureau with the others because its content was too shameful. And because of that, Nelly missed it when she destroyed the rest of them. Towards the end of the diary, Pieter describes how his daughter was sent to an old-fashioned girls' boarding school. Yuna stops in front of the stolen car and thinks that Nelly was 14 when she started at Klukhammer School outside Örebro. She was at boarding school for 6 years. It's possible that she didn't see her parents at all during that time, but never let go of her fixation on her father. The feeling of loving and being rejected, of giving everything and having everything taken from you, led to her developing a serious personality disorder. She studied her mother, tried to be like her, to take her place. Rocky has got his shoes back on, but is holding his socks in his hand as he comes down to the car park and opens the door. Is the unclean preacher a woman? Yuna asks.
I don't think so, Rocky replies, looking him in the eye.
Do you remember Nelly Brunt?
No,
he says, getting in the passenger seat. Yuna removes the plastic covering the ignition cylinder, twines the red wires together, removes the tape from the brown starter wires, and touches the ends together, causing a spark as the engine bursts into life. I don't know how much you remember from being hypnotized, Yuna says as he drives, but you talked about the first time you saw the unclean preacher. You met her at a funeral here in Schöldinger, but the person you described was the priest in the coffin, her father, Pieter. Rocky doesn't answer, just stares blankly through the windscreen as their speed increases along the narrow road through the fields and forest. Yuna thinks that the mother went to fetch her grown-up daughter from Klukhammer School and let her drive back. Her mother was sitting next to her, maybe took her seat belt off when they turned off the main road and drove up to the church. Nelly probably saw her father in the windows of the rectory as she suddenly put her foot down and drove straight into the wall. Perhaps her mother wasn't dead, just badly hurt and trapped in the wreckage. In which case, what Eleanor saw through the rain makes sense. Nelly fetched the car jack from the boot and beat her mother in the face until she was dead. Perhaps she set light to the car in front of her father's eyes. But after her mother's death, Nelly looked after him, isolated him from the world around him, keeping him to herself and becoming everything for him. Her father lived another 2 years. Nelly kept him locked up and helpless, keeping him in a cage and making him dependent on morphine. She would let him out on Sundays and gave him sermons that she had written for the morning service. He was broken, a wreck, an addict. Yuna thinks that they may have had fragments of normal life. It isn't unusual that people who are held captive for a long period of time
are allowed short periods of normal life with their captor. Perhaps they ate dinner together, sat on the sofa, watched particular television programs. In the end, he worked out how to lock his cage from the inside and slept on the mattress. It's possible that he died of an overdose unless he just got ill. A large number of priests attended the funeral, some of them sitting in the pews while others assisted with the ceremony. One of those priests was Rocky Shirklund from the parish of Salem. "They've just driven past Flynn, and a lake is shimmering silver and blue to the right of the car," as Yuna takes out his phone, brings up a list of staff at the Karolinska Institute, and finds a photograph of Nelly. "Look at this picture," he says. Rocky takes the phone, holds the screen away from the daylight, and then gasps for breath. "Stop!" he roars. "Stop the car!" He opens the door as they're speeding along, but it hits a railing and bounces back, and glass from the broken window flies into the car. The door is hanging loose, scraping along the tarmac. Yuna pulls over to the verge and comes to a halt with two wheels up on the grass. A lorry blows its horn angrily behind them and passes so close that the ground shakes. Rocky walks out into the field beside the road, striding past the plastic-wrapped bales of hay lying scattered across the ground, stops, and holds his face in his hands. Chapter 120. Yuna sits there with the engine running, picks his phone off the floor, and tries to call Eric again. Rocky stands in the field with his face turned up towards the sky for a long while before returning to the car. He yanks the broken door off, tosses it in the ditch, and gets back in his seat.
"I remember her," he says, without looking at Yuna. "She had her head shaved, pale as candle wax. She went to Klukhammer school. After the funeral, I had sex with her on the floor of the hall in the rectory. It didn't mean anything. We'd been talking and drinking coffee, and I was in no hurry to get home."
Yuna says nothing, aware that even though the photograph triggered Rocky's memory, the flood of information is finite. He could lose touch with his past again at any moment.
"I remember it all," Rocky says dreamily. "She came looking for me in Salem, came to the services. She was just there as part of my life, without me really realizing how it had happened."
He drifts off in thought and pokes a cigarette out of the packet with trembling hands. His rough gray hair is frizzy, and his thick eyebrows have tightened across the top of his nose.
"I'm a priest," he says eventually, "but I'm also a man. I do things I might not always be proud of. I'm not boyfriend material. I'm clear about that. I've never been faithful, or..."
He falls silent again, as if the strength of his memories has taken his breath away.
"Sometimes I slept with her. Sometimes she had to wait. I never promised her anything. I didn't want her fucking sermons. I remember it was always about me watching out for promiscuous women. Her house is the way to hell."
The car shakes as a bus drives past, and Yuna sees Rocky gaze out across the field and lake at the little cluster of trees in the distance.
"When I told her I was fed up with her, she disappeared," he goes on. "But I understood that she was still creeping around outside the rectory. I opened the door and shouted into the darkness, telling her to leave me the fuck alone."
He stops talking again and Yuna waits in silence so as not to pull Rocky out of his fragile reminiscences.
The following evening, she came to the church with 20 capsules of white heroin, and it all started again. It went fucking fast, he says, looking gloomily at Yuna. I was hooked as good as instantly. We shared needles. She followed me everywhere, talking about God, preaching, sank into squalor with me, wanted to be with me, wanted to be part of me.
He shakes his head and rubs his face.
We hung out at the zone. I didn't care about all her preaching. It was mostly extreme interpretations of the Bible, proof that we should get married. A whole worldview in which a jealous God proved her right.
A trace of pain flashes in his eyes as he looks darkly at Yuna.
I was drugged and stupid, he says. I told her I loved Natalia. It wasn't true, but I still said it.
All the energy goes out of him, and his chin sinks to his chest.
Natalia had such beautiful hands, he says,
then falls silent. His face is suddenly very pale, and he looks out at the fields. His forehead is shiny with sweat, and a drop falls from his nose onto his chest.
You were talking about Natalia, Yuna says after a while.
What?
Rocky looks at him uncomprehendingly, leans out of the car and spits on the grass. A car pulling a trailer full of chopped wood drives past.
Nelly showed pictures of the people she was planning to kill, Yuna goes on. But Natalia had to die in front of you.
Rocky shakes his head.
All I know is that God lost me somewhere along the way and didn't bother to go back and look, he mutters hoarsely.
Yuna doesn't say anything more. He takes his phone out and calls Eric's number again, but still can't get through. He calls Margot, but gives up after 10 rings. Now he knows who the preacher is, but he can't prove anything, and he's got nothing to give the police. There's a chance that Margot might listen to him, but he may well have gone too far when he broke Rocky out of jail. Yuna tries to understand why Nelly has been stalking Eric. They're only colleagues, and Nelly is married to Martin Brandt. It must have been going on for years, and it isn't going to end well. Chapter 121. Grit flies up behind them as they set off again. The car fills with a thunderous, jolting wind. As Yuna pushes the car as hard as it will go, he tries to get a picture of the serial killer clear in his mind. After they had sex following her father's funeral, Nelly transferred her affections to Rocky. She stalked him, followed him, made herself part of his life, tried to control him with drugs, and killed the women who threatened their union. She created an impossible life for Rocky by making sure he was the main suspect for the murder of Rebecca Hanson. In the end, she kept him in a cage, was supplying him with heroin, and thought she owned him completely when he managed to escape. He stole a car in Finsta and crashed on his way to Arlanda. The accident left him with serious brain damage. He lost all appeal to her and ended up being sentenced to secure psychiatric care. Maybe Nelly caught sight of Eric when he was called in as an expert witness during Rocky Sjöklund's trial. Yuna shudders at the thought that Nelly probably started stalking Eric as long ago as that, slowly and systematically getting closer to him. She studied and got her qualifications, got a job at the same place as him, married Martin, and supported Eric during his separation from Simone. After the divorce, her assumption of ownership grew stronger, and she started to keep watch on him, couldn't bear any sign of competition, and became pathologically jealous. She probably wanted him to choose her of his own accord, that he would have eyes for no one but her. But when that didn't happen, something snapped inside her, and she had to act in order to stop herself falling apart. When Eric embarked on an affair with Maria Carlson, she probably thought everything would be fine if she could just get rid of her rival. A stalker always develops a relationship with their victim in their imagination, a relationship that they convince themselves is real and reciprocated. In her head, Nellie may have believed that she was married to Eric, and when she saw him betraying her with Maria Carlson, attracted by Sandra Lundgren, flirting with Susanna Kern, and maybe just smiling at Katrina Youssef, a vicious beast woke up. Yuna turns off towards Malmköping, stops in the car park outside Lindholm's floor and building services, and switches to a better car. They're driving along the E20 motorway at 190 kilometers an hour when Margot calls from her private phone. "There's a warrant out for your arrest. Did you know that?" she asks. "I know, but you're going to end up in prison for this." She cuts him off. "It was worth it," he replies quietly. A few seconds of silence follow. "Now I realize why you're a better detective than me," Margot says in a subdued voice. Yuna overtakes a black Corvette on the inside and pulls out again just in time to overtake an articulated lorry with a mustard yellow trailer. "Our forensics team have found strands of Eric's hair in Sandra Lundgren's bath. We've already got his fingerprints on the deer's head. He's connected to all the victims. He's got thousands of hours of video recordings in his basement, and it's too much," Yuna says. "And the analysis of the blood in Eric's car showed that it was Susanna Kern's. And now it's getting too much even for me," she says heavily. "Good," Yuna says. "Eric's a doctor. This doesn't make sense. Because all four murders show clear signs of forensic awareness. And someone like that doesn't end up with blood in their own car. Someone left those